This is the World Vision Report. In South Africa, a rapist apologizes to his victim.
My goal was just to tell her how sorry I am, how ignorant I have been, to ask for forgiveness if she can forgive me.
And kids at a Palestinian refugee camp reclaim their childhoods.
Only play the one thing that they like can take them out of this situation. Play is something they like to do.
Plus, ever meet a walking jukebox? They're all over the subway in Mexico City. That's where vendors sell pirated CDs and play samples on the trains. Around the world, with the World Vision Report. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. December 1st was World AIDS Day. And this year, for the first time, there's good news to report. The number of new infections is down. The World Health Organization says new cases of HIV have decreased by about 17% in the past 8 years. Dr. Laura Gay is the Vice President of Research at the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation. We asked her what's behind the changes.
It's really a combination. It's education in terms of making the information available for the how to prevent acquisition of the infection, how to prevent transmission for those who are positive. This is providing resources in terms of prevention such as condoms, abstinence training, really a comprehensive approach at all levels to affect these changes.
So we've noted that the number of new infections is dropping, but the number of people living with HIV continues to rise. Can you explain that disparity?
Yes, this is actually a good sign in that it reflects the fact that people that are living with HIV are actually living longer, so that with the advent of HIV drugs for treatment, and particularly the ability to provide these drugs and services to large parts of the developing world, which previously did not have access to such therapies, that in fact the number of HIV-infected individuals who are living longer goes up.
And Dr. Gay, we also have another bit of good news, and that is that the World Health Organization has recently said that HIV-positive mothers in developing countries should breastfeed their babies. And this wasn't what they believed in the past. In fact, they were recommending mothers who had AIDS not to breastfeed in case that the virus was transmitted through the breast milk. Why have scientists changed their recommendations?
What we've learned over the last several years as we follow HIV-infected women in the developing world more closely is that while there is a risk of transmitting HIV to the baby through breastfeeding, that only about 10 to 15 out of 100 of those babies would become infected, there's a significant risk of infant mortality for those women who don't breastfeed. They don't have access to safe formula. They may not have access to safe water, so that the growth problems, the infections, lead to the babies having a higher death rate. So the changes in the WHO guidelines have really reflect the fact that we know that breastfeeding is the best method of feeding a baby and the safest method of feeding the babies. The new information that we have includes studies that have been done that show that now we can actually provide HIV drugs to either a mother who's breastfeeding or to her infant during the breastfeeding period that will reduce the chance that that baby will become infected. So it actually allows babies to breastfeed more safely and minimize the risk of HIV infection and allow them to maximize the benefit that they get from breastfeeding.
But I'm wondering, what percentage of HIV-infected women in the developing world have access to the drugs they would need?
Currently, the estimates from 2008 show that approximately 45% of HIV-infected pregnant women across the world have access to a program for the prevention of mother-to-child transmission, which would include access to the testing, the HIV counseling, and the anti-HIV drugs to help prevent transmission. So while this is significantly better than we've had previously, it's still a big gap that we need to address. So over half of the women still don't have access to any services for the prevention of mother-to-child transmission. So while we're very excited about the recommendations and the study results, we're only going to realize our expectation of eliminating pediatric HIV and AIDS if we can make sure that all women who are HIV infected and pregnant have access to these services.
Dr. Laura Gay, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Laura Gay is Vice President of Research at the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation. Conservationist William Powers worked for 5 years protecting the rainforest in the Amazon. During his work there, he saw firsthand how global economic conditions affect the daily lives of Bolivian Indians. Here's William's aid worker diary.
Deep in the Bolivian Amazon, I met perhaps the last speaker of the Guarasuwe language. She was a 70-something woman named Ernestina, with bright ebony eyes. When Ernestina dies, her language dies with her. Her people used to live in the rainforest, but over the years, logging and rubber operations and big soy plantations have taken over much of this land, destroying the forests and corralling Ernestina's people into ever tinier areas. Many of them have fled into far-off cities. They are now so-called pavement Indians, unable to assimilate, begging for scraps on the street corner. Ernestina's tribe is not alone. Many of the Amazon's indigenous people are now environmental refugees, forced to migrate into third-world urban sprawl. But I find hope 5 hours away by motorized canoe in Medidi National Park. The indigenous Quechua and Achupiamonas people who live there are thriving. It seems that the same global economy that destroyed Ernestina's people might help save them. Here's how. With the help of Conservation International, they've built a nature lodge called Chalalan. During a visit, I marvel as noisy spider monkeys crash down from the rainforest canopy. I machete a jungle vine and gulp pure water out of it. And I rise early to track jaguars and the elusive tapir, an almost comical mammal that looks like a cross between a cow and a pig. The lodge's well-trained guides are indigenous. So is everyone else, from the cooks to the general manager. Still, there are encroaching threats to this paradise. Loggers, ranchers, and oilmen have all been eyeing the forest, despite the land status as a national park. As elsewhere in the cash-poor world, the area is protected on paper, but at day's end, greenbacks usually trump green trees. Thankfully, the Bolivian government recognizes that Chalalan generates $1 million in tourist revenues each year. One night during dinner at the Airy Lodge, I suddenly become nervous. A guest from California discovers a hair in her food. She tells the waiter. He pauses, a confused expression coming over his face. I know from working in Bolivia for several years that such a detail is not significant in his culture. And to waste food is an insult to Pachamama, or Mother Earth. The Californian is paying $100 a night to stay at Chalalan, so the waiter must temporarily suspend his worldview and see things from her perspective. It's a difficult thing to do. And it also saddens me. Why should he have to kiss up to every tourist that comes into his forest? But then I remember Ernestina, whose people are about to go extinct. In an imperfect world, this lodge may be his people's best hope. I know that if he picks the hair out with his fingers or shrugs and walks away, Chalalan is lost. Other non-indigenous tour companies are in the area. They know how to cater to Western whims. As he's about to speak, I draw a breath of anticipation. The waiter picks up her plate and says, courteously, "Let me bring you another one." When he returns, minutes later, he carries a steamy, hair-free plate of Amazon river fish. When he places it in front of her, she smiles. So does the waiter. Perhaps he senses that in her smile is his people's survival.
That was conservationist and writer William Powers. We caught up with him just before he headed to Copenhagen for the UN Conference on Climate Change. Top of the agenda in Copenhagen is how to slow down global warming. That's of great interest to William Powers, who's working to protect the world's forests. Bill, we just heard a tale from you about your experiences in a developing country. And now you're about to help represent the interests of some other developing countries at the major climate change conference coming up in Copenhagen. And I'm wondering, what do countries like Bolivia want to get out of this meeting?
Well, thanks, Peggy. I think what they want are two things. The first is adaptation. They're already seeing the effects of climate change. For example, I'm talking to you from Bolivia right now, and if you look up at the glaciers, they're melting. right before our eyes. And the other day I was up at the Chakaltaya ski resort, and there's no longer snow or any way to ski up there because of the melting of the glaciers, and that's causing about 2 million people to be short on water supply. So countries like Bolivia want to be able to adapt to climate change that's already happening and that will continue to happen, and they're demanding resources for that from the developed countries. And the second thing is they would like to have technology transfer, especially for wind, solar, geothermal. They're saying that they should be able to also develop these technologies in their own country.
What do you mean by technology transfer?
Well, essentially, it's providing the financing so that countries like Brazil, India, Bolivia, and others can develop their own clean energy. The idea in the developing world, like here in Bolivia, they talk a lot here in La Paz about a clean development pattern. Instead of developing like the U.S. did or like Europe did through a lot of carbon dioxide, a lot of burning, a lot of coal and oil, and spewing gases into the atmosphere, they'd like to develop through solar, wind, hydroelectric, and other types of clean energies. But in order to do that, of course, they would need the technology and the financing to do it.
Now, Bill, you have a particular interest in saving forests around the world. Why are you so focused on forests? And I know rainforests in particular in Bolivia.
Well, you know, forests, they actually act as a sponge, and they suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and they help to cool a warming planet. So, for example, 20% of greenhouse gases are caused by deforestation. So that's more than the entire transport sector put together, more than all the cars, buses, trucks, and et cetera in the world. So what I'm arguing, and I have a new paper out on this in the World Policy Journal, and I'm arguing that what we need to do is save the last forests on the planet so they continue to serve this function.
We should tell our listeners that you ran the largest successful program in Bolivia to save a huge swath of rainforest there. And your program aims to reduce the effects of climate change. And we'll hear more about this next week when we check in with you in Copenhagen. But what are you hoping to hear at this meeting when it comes to saving the world's forests?
Well, I'm hoping to hear that the world will come together and see forests as the glue that can unite everyone in terms of climate change. It's the low-hanging fruit. It's the cheapest way to reduce global warming because you don't have to develop new technologies or install scrubbers on smokestacks and so on. We already have these forests. So my hope, and I think it's going to happen, I'm cautiously optimistic, is that in Copenhagen we're going to set a framework for how this is going to happen that will lay out an actual model and an actual process by which developing countries are going to be rewarded for conserving their forests.
Okay, Bill, it's great to talk to you again, and I hope you have a safe flight to Copenhagen, and we'll look forward to speaking with you next week.
Okay, thanks, Peggy. It was great to talk with you.
Coming up, there's a rape epidemic in South Africa. We speak with a man who was part of the problem and now is part of the solution. That's ahead on the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. This is the World Vision Report. Every 17 seconds, a woman is raped in South Africa. A recent study showed that one out of every four men in that country admitted to having raped a woman. Dumisani Rabambo was a teenager in a small South African village when he raped a girl there. According to Dumisani, the story began when his father wouldn't allow him to have a traditional African circumcision. The boys in the village taunted him for being unmanly. We'll let Dumisani pick up the story from here. Just a note, some of what you're about to hear might be disturbing.
My father didn't have cows, nor sheep, or goats, which I would look after. So as a result, I would, after school, go home and be at home or assist my mom or my two sisters. And that was seen as a no-no. You know, why would you do sissy work? First, you don't want to go to initiation school. The next thing, you are going into the kitchen and following dresses.
So I imagine that these boys, when you would come to school, would harass you and tease you, call you a sissy, and say you weren't a real man yet because of the way you were living.
Yes. Not only at school, I played sports and soccer at the time, and I was good at it. But even in the soccer field. So basically, wherever he went. The only safe place was inside the classroom when the teacher was present. So you would have this constant jeering, name-calling wherever you went. Thirdly, was that I was not ready to have a girlfriend, nor to have sex at the time. And this was seen as the aftermath or the result of me not being man enough. So then came a time when a plan was devised that there was this girl in the village who did not want to go out with any of the boys. They decided that she needed to be straightened up. And straightening her up meant having to rape her.
You remember what you thought when they brought this up?
Yeah, I remember that I was terrified. One, because my family in the village had, some high standing in the community. So it was despicable to think of me doing something that was against my family values. I just remember being terrified, and I remember I refused. This could have gone on for maybe 2 months. Not that I condone my action, but until I succumbed to this pressure. And I agreed, and they decided, because I was shaking, and they decided, you know what, let's go buy beer and some dacha.
What's dacha?
Dacha is marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
They knew the times when, you know, the girls will go to the rivers to fetch water. And the three of us were assigned to a spot next to a football pitch. Two other boys came with this girl there. Yeah, this guy just, you know, forcefully put her down to the ground and started raping. And when it was done, he said, "It's your turn."
Wow.
I don't recall vividly what exactly transpired in the sense that I was just terrified. I didn't even spend much time there. Yeah, and you know, I stood up, he went back on again, this guy. He slapped her on the face and told her to run, and she did just that, and that was it.
Oh. And how old were you?
I was 15.
Dumisani, after this happened, you went back eventually to your high school friends, the guys, and what did they say? They knew you had done this? How did they respond to what you had done?
Well, I didn't report, you know, to the group, but my, you know, the other guy did. Believe it or not, the guys just started clapping because, yeah, you know, we've taught her a lesson, you know, like, well done, guys, good job. That was like everybody in the team.
So suddenly, in their estimation, you had now become a man and you were accepted into the group after this?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, 50% of the jeering went off.
Dumisani put what happened out of his mind and he went on with his life. But he says he was forced to remember this experience later as an adult.
I started volunteering for HIV prevention awareness campaigns. And I, at the same time, there was a bit of religion where I learned a bit about, you know, loving your neighbor as you love yourself. And that translated, how could you forcibly, rape someone? Or do any other thing that you wouldn't want it to be done to yourself. I couldn't help it but go back to that time when I was 15 and thinking of the other boys around me. And it just added a burden to me that we need to do something about this. Because I remember how relaxed the other boys around me were. It was as if nothing has happened to that woman. Even with me, later on, yes, I was scared, worried, but that faded on.
And only at this time, when I was working with these women, I would go back to what has happened many years ago. And that is when I decided to go and apologize to the woman.
So you found this young woman, and what was your goal in meeting her again?
My goal was just to tell her how sorry I am, how ignorant I have been, to ask for forgiveness if she can forgive me.
Was that an enormous relief, or was it really frightening, or maybe both?
It was both. But when I left her, because when I spoke to her, she said, you know, she just cried, and afterwards she said, look, two men after you raped me too.
Oh.
And my life, she said, has never been the same. And I've never told anyone. I felt like I had an added burden on me, on my shoulders. Because I then thought, there I was for many years, waking up and, you know, going about my life. And someone was underpinned to this type of emotions because of my actions. That was more heavier than the first time I went to see her.
Is this a story you tell often, or how difficult is this for you to share this story with us?
I've told it many times, that is true. But every time I talk about it, yeah, I feel hurt. I don't know how she is today as I speak with you right now. Yeah, so it's not easy.
You have done something unusual. You've had this experience in
yes.
your own life. And yet now you actually are working with an organization that tries to educate men to change their views about women mm-hmm. and rape. Tell us a little bit about that organization, if you would, and what you're doing.
My organization is called Olive Leaf Foundation. We have many programs. We're all about HIV prevention, care and support. You know, we take care of orphans and vulnerable children. But we also have a gender program, which is looking into HIV prevention, the prevention of gender-based violence, working with boys and men to embrace gender equality.
But do you see men changing in your program? Are there any stories or cases of men where you've been able to talk to them, share your story, give them tools to turn their attitudes around, and you've actually seen them change?
Yes, so many stories. And that's what keeps us going. That's what says, let's find as many people as possible to even create new tools, new ways of addressing this, you know, move forward and let this be a social movement.
Dumisani Rabombo, thank you so much for your openness with us today and for sharing your experiences with us.
Thank you, Peggy. Thank you for the time.
Dumisani Rabombo lives in South Africa. He works for the Olive Leaf Foundation, counseling young men about rape and sexual violence. In Mexico City, pirated CDs are sold everywhere, even on the subways. Vendors there have found an innovative way to sell to captive audiences. They convert their backpacks into boomboxes so that riders can hear samples of the music they're selling. Our reporter Grant Fuller rode the rails with a group of CD vendors, and he filed this story for our Street Vendor series.
It happens all the time on the subway. Suddenly, the car you're riding in is filled with the sound of music. At first, it's unclear where it's coming from, and then you hear the sales pitch. Standing in the middle of the train car, a vendor holds up a stack of pirated CDs. He scans the passengers, hoping for a nod, a wink, any sign that someone's ready to buy. He's got an old Sony Discman in his hand, with a wire running to his backpack. It's been creatively customized to serve as a walking boombox. Joel Andrade explains the backpack basics.
You buy a backpack and you stuff these two speakers inside. Then you buy a small amp and a battery, put them in the backpack and connect them, and that's it. But the key is that the bag has mesh sides so that the sound can get out. If you don't have that, well, then you have to cut holes in it. See, mine has this thin fabric where the audio comes through.
The music they sell depends on what vendors can find at Tepito, the city's biggest market for pirated CDs. Salsa, rock, ranchera, reggaeton, jazz, oldies, it's all there, and you can find it all on the subway. Believe it or not, the backpack music vendors are seriously organized. Most are part of a collective, and instead of having vendors wander aimlessly through the entire subway system, the collectives divvy up territories. That way, each group handles one stretch of train line exclusively. The collective Andrade belongs to has 150 members. They work 7 stops on a train line on the south side of Mexico City. Back and forth, back and forth, Jose Romero says. Every time a train comes, vendors take turns hopping on, one at a time. This system helps avoid competition amongst themselves.
You have to stay behind and wait for your turn. You can go before or after. We'll know whose turn it is to go, so it helps establish order and make sure there's no conflict or fighting.
By the time they reach the last of their stops, vendors have passed through the entire length of the train. Most of them say they can make about $15 a day, with an average of 1 sale per trip. In Mexico, that's a pretty good day's work, but it's also risky business.
Sometimes you can make a little more, but other days you don't sell anything, or the Metro Police catch you, and after you pay the fine, you haven't earned anything. They caught me yesterday.
Still, a lot of them actually prefer the job's flexibility. Guadalupe Flores has 2 kids. She picks them up from school after a full day of selling music on the subway.
Here I can make the rounds as I please. I don't have a fixed schedule. I can arrive anytime I want and I can leave whenever I want. I don't have anyone checking up on me or rushing me. It's just me. That's why I like it.
Daniel Rodriguez is president of the Vendors Advisory Council. It's a union-like organization that fights for the rights of people who sell anything and everything on the subway. He says the global economic crisis has been especially hard on the music vendors.
Right now it's not so easy for people to buy a CD from you because they're going to prefer to keep that money for their train fare or to buy themselves something to eat. The crisis doesn't give anyone the luxury of having money left over to spend, so it makes our job difficult.
But it's not all doom and gloom here. Smiling vendors constantly trade little jokes and jabs, making the day go by faster. Back on the train, one vendor shares a silent laugh with someone he thought wanted to buy a CD. Turns out the guy was just stretching. The vendor bobs and weaves his way through the train car, squeezing between poles and people, tiptoeing over a teenager sitting on the floor. At the next stop, he decides this car is no good for a sale. So he bolts out the sliding doors and scurries across the platform to the next car 3 doors down. He leaps into the train as the doors jam on his speaker-stuffed backpack. After a passenger pulls him inside, he turns around, pointing and laughing, at me, left behind on the platform. He shrugs as the train carries him down the track, and music blares from his backpack. For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Mexico City.
You can see the boomboxes in the backpacks on our website, worldvisionreport.org.
Hi, Ishma Fundikwa here, guide to global music for the World Vision Report. That's a pretty cool idea, music from a backpack vendor. But those who didn't hear their music are sure to hear this song. It's called Estuve, and it's top of the charts in Mexico City.
Poro de su piel, pero hoy no estoy, está con él, y es lo que cuenta. Saldada la cuenta ya quedó. Aquí el perdedor he sido yo. es tu ley y fui el primer conquistador en esa tierra donde el sol gritó te amo. Te queda buen tramo por andar y a mí la lección asimilar. Que no estuve cuando más debía, cuando ella quería sentirse mujer. No estuve, pero estaba loco por volverla a ver.
That was Alejandro Fernandez and the song Estuve. Later in the show, you'll hear music by Somali rapper Kanan, an incredible talent who I was lucky enough to see live only last week in Harare, Zimbabwe. Kanan has accompanied the Soccer World Cup to almost every African country as it makes its way to South Africa, where the soccer spectacle is going to be held in Africa for the first time next year. Kanan's Waving Flag is the official anthem of the 2010 Soccer World Cup. I'll also speak with host Peggy Waymire about Kanan's journey from war-torn Mogadishu to North America, where he has established himself as one of the world's leading rappers. So stay with us for that. This is Ishma Fundikwa, and you are listening to the World Vision Report.
For that fateful day, it's not far away, but for now we say, when I get older, I will be stronger, they'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag, and then it goes back, and then it goes back, and then it goes back, oh. So many wars, settling scores, bringing us promises, leaving us poor. I heard them say, love is the way, love is the answer, that's what they say. But look how they treat us, make us believers. We fight their battles, then they deceive us. Try to control us, they couldn't hold us. Cause we just move forward like buffalo soldiers.
But we struggling,
fighting to eat.
And we wondering,
when we'll be free.
So we patiently wait
for that fateful day.
You're back with the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. A few days ago, Israel proposed a 10-month freeze on settlements in the West Bank. But Palestinians say that's not enough. They want the freeze to include East Jerusalem as well. And that's led to yet another stalemate in the path towards Middle East peace. More than 50 years ago, thousands of Palestinians fled from their homes after the creation of the State of Israel. Many of them headed to northern Lebanon, where the UN set up the Badawi refugee camp. An astounding 43,000 people are still packed into that camp in an area less than 1 square mile. The situation has been called a forgotten crisis, but one organization is working to improve life in the camp through child's play. Ken Shulman explains.
A whistle blows and 12 kindergarten students run around 11 hoops laid out on the playground floor. The whistle blows again, and the kids scurry to step inside a hoop. A teacher takes away one hoop, and then another. At the final whistle, all 12 kids squirm their way into a single hoop. It's a simple game, a variation on musical chairs that kids anywhere in the world could play. But here in Badawi Refugee Camp, the game is really a lesson about sharing. And that lesson is drawn up by instructor Mona Saeed. She works for the organization Right to Play, which operates in all 12 of Lebanon's Palestinian camps. It develops games that help children learn and adapt to difficult conditions. Here's how Saeed talked with the kids after the game.
We ask them, if somebody come to share you with your hoop and you will refuse or you will accept. One of them, they said, no, I will not accept. One of them, they said, yes, I will accept. I said, why? He said, I feel pity on him because he has no place, so I can share my place with him.
Sharing desks and beds and homes is a lesson that's paramount here. 2 years ago, fighting leveled another nearby refugee camp and sent an additional 25,000 refugees into Badawi, more than doubling its population. Conditions in the camp, already difficult, became almost insufferable. And the new kids from the Nahr el-Bared camp brought problems of their own. Amel Khaled coordinates remedial classes in Badawi.
We asked the children to draw pictures on paper. The children from Badawi drew happy pictures of them playing, of a wedding. But the Nahr el-Bared children drew pictures about war and killing, or about weddings where the bride and groom were both dead.
To help children like these, Write to Play teams with local teachers, youth leaders, and coaches, running workshops and helping in the classroom.
Only play, the one thing that they like, can take them out of this situation.
Tarek Kordam is one of Right to Play's project coordinators in northern Lebanon.
In play, they can express all their feelings, all their abilities, and play is something they like to do. So we can use play as an instrument to achieve our goals.
Younger children learn to share through games like musical hoops. Teenagers blow off steam and learn responsibility through soccer and basketball, as well as team-building exercises like this one. The teenage girls on the camp basketball team crowd into a tight circle on the balcony at Right to Play's Badawi office. Working in pairs, the first girl describes a scene to her partner. The second girl sketches the scene and passes the drawing back to the first girl, who adds to it and passes it on again. It's an exercise in communication, one that 17-year-old Jemana Gajeni also learns from playing basketball, as she explains while the noontime prayer wafts in from the neighboring mosque.
I love basketball. I love it so much. It teaches new skills. It gives you confidence. It teaches good communication with friends. I've grown so much from playing, and I've invited all my friends to join me at practice.
The residents of Badawi and the other refugee camps in Lebanon live with poverty and discrimination beneath the perpetual shadow of war. Right to Play hopes its games will help normalize the lives of the kids here, who grow up in a situation that is anything but normal. For the World Vision Report, I'm Ken Schulman in Badawi Camp in Lebanon.
In a world where there is so much wealth, with modern cities and plentiful resources, how can we still have so much poverty?
That's the question posed in the documentary titled The End of Poverty, and it's a question filmmaker Philippe Diaz sets out to answer in his film. Rachel Clift has this review.
Actor Martin Sheen serves as a passionate narrator for The End of Poverty. He takes viewers on a step-by-step journey to explore the film's thesis that global poverty is not an accident, but rather a man-made phenomenon that found its footing through colonization, land seizure, and slave labor. Director Philip Diaz begins with the notorious Spanish expedition of 1492 and travels all the way through the 20th century to a corrupted, wildly free market system that many would agree caused one of the biggest financial crises in modern history. Diaz's essential and disturbing message is that the wealth of nations is, and always has been, built on oppression and greed. The documentary features interviews with esteemed authors, professors, and economists who make that case. They connect the dots between the economic prosperity of the Northern Hemisphere and the mind-numbing hardship faced by people in the developing world. Meanwhile, profiles of Brazilian farmers, Bolivian miners, and Kenyan coffee growers tell a heartbreaking story of resource exploitation and insurmountable debt. But missing from this film is any nod to another equally credible point of view. That is, the reasons for today's persistent poverty crisis may have shifted from colonization to pressing issues like overpopulation and climate change, but you won't find them mentioned in this documentary. The End of Poverty also tries to be epic in scope, which doesn't always serve the film or its audience very well. With so much to cover in so little time, it provides only a general overview of what is, in reality, an extremely complex and nuanced subject. The experts Diaz interviews, most of whom, it's worth noting, are white European men, do lend a vast array of knowledge to the film, but they rarely convey the depth of the crisis as effectively as those who are actually fighting for economic survival. As a result, The End of Poverty comes across as a dry, albeit devastating, history lesson with little in the way of grassroots solutions. It's interesting that Diaz chose not to explore the potentially transformative anti-poverty initiatives that non-governmental organizations are putting into place around the globe. Viewers seeking a glimmer of hope would do well to revisit the brief scene in which a congregation of a small Bolivian church performs a traditional song. The music is as proud and persistent as a battle cry, the melody as strong and determined as those who sing. If we are to achieve the end of poverty in our lifetime, here is the kind of force that will make it possible.
Rachel Clift is an award-winning documentary producer. She reviewed the film The End of Poverty, which is currently showing in select theaters around the country. To find out more, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. As reviewer Rachel Clift said, there are many nonprofit organizations working in the developing world to put an end to poverty. Just this month, the International Food Policy Research Institute published a book called Millions Fed. It highlights 20 successful agricultural programs that increased access to food for millions. Today, we look at the program that focuses on fish, tilapia to be precise. In the Philippines, a tilapia breeding program provided cheaper fish for more than 19 million people. Here's the editor of Millions Fed, David Spielman, explaining how scientists came up with a new kind of tilapia.
They were looking for a tilapia strain that would increase in size and weight rapidly, that would come to maturity quickly, and that would have a strong survival rate.
What difference has this tilapia farming made for the people in the Philippines?
The benefit has really accrued to consumers in the Philippines because they've enjoyed a decrease in the price of the food they buy, the price of the protein source they buy, tilapia, ranging from about 32 to 35% over the years of this project. That's about the late 1980s to the late 1990s. They've seen an increase of 186% in terms of tilapia production. So there's more tilapia available on the market. So, you know, those two things combined help poor people who spend more of their income, say, on tilapia and fish generally than rich people.
Are there any lessons here from this tilapia project for helping people grow tilapia or even other fish or make money and have more to eat?
This story reinforces the importance of two things. One, agricultural science and technology. If we don't have long-term sustained investments in agricultural science and technology, it's very hard to promote agricultural development. And again, it's a very long-term undertaking. This project itself ran for at least a decade. There are many other projects that run for decades and decades because improving crops is very difficult, improving livestock is very difficult, and improving fish is very difficult. Another important lesson learned from the improvement of tilapia in the Philippines was that international cooperation is also very important. Just the idea of moving fish genetic material between countries to promote improved tilapia breeding in Bangladesh, in Philippines, in Vietnam, and elsewhere, requires a good international system for research.
That was David Spielman, one of the editors of the book, Millions Fed.
When I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag. When I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag.
You're listening to the song Waving Flag by Somali singer Kanon. It's been named the official anthem of the 2010 Soccer World Cup, which takes place next summer in South Africa. Kanon's come a long way. He was born in Somalia, a country known better for its pirates and Islamic radicals than its rappers. Kanon was lucky. He managed to get out of Somalia and settle in Canada. Our guide to global music, Ish Mafundukwa, is here to tell us more about Kanon. How you doing, Ish?
I'm doing good, Peggy. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. I wanna start this interview off by, first let's talk about Kanon's childhood. He was raised on some very rough streets in Mogadishu. What was life like for him growing up there?
I can only imagine it, but it was really difficult because he grew up during the civil war in Somalia. death, gunshots, and violence was a backdrop all the time that he was growing up in a very rough neighborhood in Mogadishu. His dad left for the United States, where he started driving a cab in New York City. And his mother was trying to get the family to join the father, and she only managed to get out on the very last commercial flight out of Mogadishu in 1991.
How old was he then, do you know?
He was only 14.
14. How did he get turned on to rap music?
Besides the money that he sent home, his dad also used to send rap albums. Kanan learned to rap to the music of Nas and Eric B. and Rakim, some of the best rappers around then. But that's how he learned, and he didn't even speak any English then, so he learned phonetically.
That's so interesting, because he didn't speak English, and yet the rap music here is about violent streets in the U.S., and yet there's no comparison with what Kanan was dealing with in Mogadishu.
Well, I mean, compared to what is happening in Mogadishu and what was happening in Mogadishu then, the violence that the rappers in the United States talk about in the ghettos is kid's play.
And I think Kanan actually has a song about this, where he's not making fun of American rap, but he's talking about, hey, what you guys have here is nothing.
We're talking about a song called What's Hardcore? And here he paints a very graphic picture of what is happening or what was happening in Somalia when he was growing up. And if anybody, you know, people listen to the news, Somalia is still very much in the news. It's still one of the most dangerous places in the world. You can't go half a block without a roadblock. You don't pay at the roadblock, you get your throat shot. And each roadblock is set up by these gangsters. And different gangsters go by different standards. For example, the evening is a no-go. Unless you want to wear a bullet like a logo. In the day, you should never take the alleyway. The only thing that validates you is the AK. They chew on chat, it's sort of like coca leaves. And ain't no police. So what's hardcore? Really? Are you hardcore? Yeah. So what's hardcore? Really? Are you hardcore? I'ma spit these verses cause I feel annoyed and I'm not gonna...
Well, this really puts American rap in perspective, doesn't it?
It surely does. It surely does.
And what's the response to him here in the United States and Canada?
Well, I can only talk about the response elsewhere in the world where I've been. And he was nominated in the Best Newcomer category and at the BBC Radio 3 Music of the World Awards in 2007. He was the most anticipated artist of the day. Unfortunately, he didn't show up because his wife had just given birth to their first child. So, but the good thing is he won that category.
Ish, Kanan hasn't forgotten his African roots, even though he sounds very much like a Western rapper. I want to know how his childhood and his home influenced the way his music sounds today, if at all.
There's still a lot of very, very strong African influences there, and he also does collaborations with African rappers, with African musicians. There's a track called Soba on the first album, The Dusty Foot Philosopher. Like the beginning of it, you'd really mistake it for an African song.
Basically, I got beef. I wanna talk to you directly. I can't ignore, I can't escape. And ask cause you affect me. You cripple me, you shackle me. You shatter my whole future in front of me. This energy is killing me. I gotta let it pour like blood soba. Nabkiwa de ten, I gala soba. Nibkiwa
baten, I gala soba. Bigiwa baten, I gala soba. You listen to the ululating, listen to the chant, just the rhythm. It could be people singing down the road for me. The rhythm, you know, the percussion, it really sounds very, very African.
His latest album is called Troubadour. It came out earlier this year. What do you think of the songs on it?
I think he's making progress. I think he's growing stronger. From what we have heard so far, it's promising to be, it will be a hit for him, you know.
I had a chance to listen to one of the songs called ABC, which again has very strong lyrics about life in Somalia. I'm from the most
pretty thought-provoking messages in that song. He's representing his reality. That's what he's doing. That's what people love about him. He's not somebody who's fronting. And
when you say fronting, you mean pretense, I take it.
Yeah, pretending, exaggerating. All these wannabe gangster rappers, you know?
Yeah, he's the real thing.
Yeah, he's the real deal.
Thanks so much, Ish. We'll be checking in with you again sometime soon.
Thanks, Peggy. As always, it was nice to be here.
So, in the beginning, there was a hum from a poet whose pulse fell drum, drum, drum. He would perform praise.
And that's it for this week. Remember, you can hear us anytime on the web, worldvisionreport.org. And you can sign up for a podcast so you can take us with you. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.